Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
You're listening to the Design Build Hunt podcast presented by Whitetail Partners. Here we cover all things whitetail property design, habitat improvement, and hunting strategy. Let's change your property for good. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Design Build Hunt podcast, which is presented by Whitetail Partners. I've got the whole crew. Well, I guess I can't say the whole crew anymore. We've got some of the originals here for Whitetail Partners on the line. We've got Sam Billhorn in Wisconsin, Lee in Tennessee, Jake in Michigan, myself, Josh Raley here in Georgia. We're missing Greg. We're missing Dylan. We're missing Brennan. We're missing Tim. So we are missing a couple of guys, but it's a full table nonetheless. So how are you guys doing this evening?
Doing well, Josh.
Good,
how are
good.
You?
Good.
Great.
Good. How's consulting season coming? We are in the heat of it right now, I guess you could say. And some folks may be wondering, what does it look like this time of year for us? And I don't want to speak for the rest of you, but it's been busy in the best possible way. So how about you guys?
Yep. I can say the same thing. Yeah, this is probably going to air, you know, a couple weeks from when we record it. So we're early February right now, but we're right in the heart of the consulting season. So it's very busy, but it's a good busy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Very good time of year. So you guys have gotten, I guess, snow where you are, pretty much non-existent, nothing to worry about at this point.
It's been the best winter ever, Josh. It's just so easy to get around. It's something we're not used to. We're used to, you know, knee deep snow and making it difficult around properties. We're just cruising right now, which is just adding to the productivity.
Right. Right. Well, I'm glad you guys are having a little bit of a reprieve. I know for us though, that means things like alligators in a food plot. And so that, you know, that's a little bit concerning when you're on a property, but yeah, it's been good so far down here in the South. We don't have to worry too much about all that snow business, but yeah, it's a good time of year. Any advice that you would give to a guy who maybe has gotten to this point? So this is going to air in a couple of weeks, maybe the end of February, early March. Somebody who feels like, man, I missed it, right? Like I missed it this year. What should he do at this time of year in March to like maybe try to get ahead for the following year? Or like, should he go ahead and reach out and try to start communicating with us if he really knows like, hey, it's not going to be until next January or February? Like, should he go ahead and start that conversation?
Yeah, I'll take that, Josh. And I'd say from the March, April standpoint, it's a great time still to be getting out there and being active doing things. There's a lot of scouting that can still be done, understanding their property. As far as our calendars, most of us are getting pretty booked up, trying to reach out and get on site and get those plans done yet this year. But there's definitely ways we can help get them going. You know, a lot of times what I'll be doing for people is getting them booked now for December so they have the prime time to be getting us out there and get their plan right after next season. And in the meantime, we have an opportunity. Maybe it's a quick walkthrough on site if it's local, or a virtual hop on, look at the plan, look at the property, give them some insights, help them maybe fine tune some places they might be missing out on hunting yet this season, and some simple projects they could jump on that would probably be incorporated into a plan. So no, it's never too late, but just it looks a little bit different this time of year trying to get people set up when that consulting season is fully booked.
Right. It might look more like you are early for next year than late for this year.
Right. But you start that conversation and that relationship. And I think that's really what differentiates us too, is that we're available to these folks and helping them start to tune into what they can get done. And even if we haven't been on site yet, there's certainly plenty of things we can do. Sometimes I'll even do a virtual plan for somebody with the intent to come out in December and fine tune it, troubleshoot it, do layout, get them going, and time is not necessarily lost.
Right. And I think a lot of us do something similar, either virtual, we can hop on a Zoom call for a Q&A type of session or something like that, just in preparation for the following year, knowing that whatever work we can accomplish will kind of be rolled into the final product, whatever that end design ends up looking like. So guys, with that in mind, you know, this is that time of year when a lot of guys are really able to get out into the woods. Like, there's a lot of good work that can be happening right now. But I think probably the most common thing that I hear from habitat and land managers, especially those who are just getting into this, right, who maybe don't have an extensive background in this, is I'm afraid I'm going to mess something up. Hey, I didn't want to do anything yet before I saw this or read this or talked to this person or whatever the case may be, because I didn't want to mess something up. And I thought, you know what? That's actually really good when it comes to a plan, from a planning perspective of, hey, don't do a whole lot before maybe you have your on-site consult, because as Jake and I talked about a couple of weeks ago, you might end up with that, I wish you hadn't done this before we talked. But at the same time, once you've got a plan for moving forward, don't let the fear of messing something up paralyze you, right? Sam, you mentioned a little bit earlier while we were talking offline, nature is very forgiving. So there are a lot of ways right. to reverse or undo or repair a potential mistake. But I thought what we could do and have a little bit of fun with this is to share some of our biggest fails. Some of the things that we have done, because I think people look at us and they say, hey, you know, these guys know what they're doing. And yeah, we do, but we learned what we're doing a lot of times by making a lot of the mistakes on the way. And that's a lot of the experience that we're bringing to individuals, right? As we're doing our consulting work, a lot of that is because we've already made the mistake. We can talk about things that we have done that didn't turn out like they were supposed to. So I thought I would just kick it over to you guys tonight and say, okay, what's the biggest fail that you've had on a property that you are managing? How did you fix it? How did you recognize it, first of all? Like, uh-oh, that didn't turn out. Then how did you fix it, and how did you recover from it? So anybody want to volunteer to go first? I don't know. Who wants to have egg on their face first so the rest of us can make fun of you a little?
I'll go. So I guess it's like, where do we start with mistakes? And with what you said there, Josh, was right on. That's how you learn. And there's a couple ways you can learn how to do this. One is by, you know, going and doing it and making mistakes. And you know, that's a great way to learn. But another way to learn, and hopefully the viewers will learn this way too, is learn from other people's mistakes. Mm-hmm. And that'll hopefully save you, you know, from having to go through the same hurdles that we did when we were kind of just getting into this stuff. And so I think I have three mistakes, and I guess I can just talk about one and then we can circle back to the others. But two of them were back when I was just getting into this. So I'm going to say, you know, 13 years ago. And I'm going to talk about two that are kind of like your big habitat improvements that you install on most properties, you know, food and bedding. So, you know, just getting into this habitat improvement stuff, I really want to put in a food plot, and I had this great spot in mind, you know, always see deer in this spot. I want to try to hold them up here a little bit, so I'm going to put in the food plot. And it's in the middle of the woods, so I just kind of went there with a rake. I raked off like an eighth of an acre spot. It took me a long time with a rake to do that. I was young, but it still took me a long time. And then I went and seeded my throw and grow food plot seed, so it was probably all ryegrass, and then it germinated, you know, perfect right before rain germinated, and then in I did this in the spring, and then once the leaf out hit, the whole plot got shaded out because I did this in the middle of the hardwoods, and my food plot just got covered up with shade and died, and so that was a big eye-opening experience for me, because now that's one of the first things you preach with food plots is it needs sunlight. You cannot grow a food plot without having sunlight. So if you're going to put a food plot in a timber setting, you have to cut the trees down, especially on the south side, because as the earth rotates in the fall, that's where that sun's going to be. So you got to make sure you have sunlight. But that was my first big mistake that I made with habitat improvements was with food plots. I created a food plot in the woods, and it was in the wrong spot too, bad seed. But the biggest mistake was I did not cut the trees down to get my sunlight, and so my food plot died.
Yeah, Jake, you had quite a list there. So what turned out not to be in a good spot, had the wrong seed, sunlight was a problem. It's like, oh man, this was a hard one for you.
I learned a lot with that one spot.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. How did you, at what point did you realize, hey, it's the being shaded out that's the problem with this? Because I think a lot of guys may have gone in there and said, oh, it's lack of rain, or oh, it's something bad with the seed, or oh, it got mowed down by the deer. They maybe wouldn't have been able to say, okay, sunlight. Like, how did you get there?
Yeah, that was just like one of those things that just kind of hit me as soon as I saw the food plot not performing in the summer. It was shaded out. Like, I mean, I understand that everything needs sunlight to grow, and so I that just was something that I wasn't thinking about when I put the food plot in, because when I put it in at the time, it was getting full sun because there was no leaves in the trees. And what's kind of funny about this food plot is I was so proud of it, you know, 10 years ago or 13 years ago. I think it was 2010 is when I did it, because Facebook reminds me every single year about this food plot, because I took a picture of it and I put it on Facebook. And food plot's going in, you know, April, whatever, or May, whatever. And then I had a couple progress pictures, and it sends me those pictures every year. And so I just keep it there as a reminder of like, you idiot, like cut the trees down. But
that's good. That's a good one to share. I have one similar to that I was thinking about from earlier, almost the same thing. Except I was pretty new to this piece of property when I did plant it. First of all, I got shaded out before it could have really turned into anything. Fall hit, leaves started to come down. It recovered just a little bit just because of the way our growing seasons work down here in the South. And after it started to recover just a little bit and the rest of the leaves came down, I very quickly realized that if I stood in that food plot, I could see, I don't know, 250 yards in any direction all the way around it. I hadn't adequately planned for what am I going to do to get to this food plot to hunt it effectively? Where are the deer coming from? So I spent the whole year putting out cameras and, you know, trying to figure out where the deer are coming from. Turns out the deer that were eventually hitting the field, I was getting them on camera, they were like half a mile away during the day. Like that's where they would be coming from. So no chance they're getting there before 2 o'clock in the morning. Right. And so lots of fails on that end. All right. Who's next, guys?
Sam, I can go. I mean, there's
all right, Lee, go ahead, buddy.
Well, I mean, you can think of all the things that, you know, we advise on and all the different, you know, habitat improvements you can make. And honestly, I can think of failures in each one of those over, you know, a 30-year hunting career. I mean, there's probably hundreds of different fails. I thought, you know, it's easy to go into hinge cutting. I mean, there was a pretty big fail there. And then food plot architecture, I would say, is a pretty big one of mine. I want to go the food plot architecture route. Sam would probably take, I figured hinge cutting would be a popular one, but
I've screwed up plenty of those.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I have screwed up those. But I'd say food plot architecture, and then, you know, how to actually hunt the food plot was probably one of my biggest mistakes, growing up, you know, 'cause we've been putting in food plots with my dad since I was 10 years old. And it's just, I can see the evolution from when I was 10 to now, and man, did we make a lot of mistakes on, you know, just the lack thereof, the food plot architecture, what it was and why it was there, how we actually hunted it. you know, just a thousand mistakes along that 30-year journey, you know, to now. And, you know, now we use food plots, you know, different types of food plots for different reasons, you know, but, you know, and when we strategically hunt them, man, that is, I just look back and it's just significantly different today. And they're so effective if you use them right and you can manipulate travel. Back then we were just like Jake, we were just, you know, just seeding and just, we got a stand and we'd hunt right over it. We'd walk right through the middle of it. We'd leave right through the middle of it. Never care about anything, you know? And yep. I was like, wow. Looking back, I, you know, it's just, there was so many fails in not having, you know, that food plot architecture and a plan of like actually how to hunt it and when to hunt it, and what they meant. So,
right.
That's been one of my biggest mistakes. And now that we've got it dialed in, oh my Lord, they're so effective. And there's different types of food plots, like a destination plot, you know, like when you approach that plot, you know, I don't like hunting food source until very, very late season in the afternoons. Like they stress me out, you know, to be honest, like they really do. I mean, going anywhere near, I like hunting the travel to and from. I mean, if you're trying to kill bucks, I'm not talking about does. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes I've made in my career, early on in my career, and that I see clients making, is that you put in these nice, lush food plots and they want to hunt food plots. I wanted to hunt the plots over the years. You hunt the travel 3/4 of the year and you wait until that last, you know, that late season game when that buck's trying to rebuild his body, you know, from the rut. Man, you can just mop up on those late season food plots. That's the only time that's pretty much the only time I hunt my food sources. So I'd say that's it. Just understanding, you know, food plot architecture and then how to actually approach those plots.
Right, right.
It's been a game changer.
Give me just a quick overview. Like if this is somebody's very first episode that they're jumping in on, give me just a quick definition and what you're talking about when you say food plot architecture.
Sure. So I'm fortunate where I live. I've got a silty loam soil. I plant a lot of soybeans. And I mix my soybeans with greens in the fall. But my greens, that's where I manipulate my travel with when I come in with my no-till drill. I will make, you know, I will use what God gave me on the DNA of my property, how they want to use the property. But, you know, those soybeans, those browse pressure beans, they'll get 6 feet tall. So they create an edge in the field. And I'll use that edge to manipulate how I want to move those deer through the plot. And where I want them to come from and where I want to dump them to, and they'll walk that edge just like, you know, cover. So they feel secure in it. And, you know, it's so manipulating travel is a big thing. And definitely if you're fortunate enough to have the soils where you can, you know, grow something with some height, man, it's real easy to manipulate. But, and those were some fails too. You know, you have your access set up, and you know, if you don't have your architecture right, sometimes you those deer enter and exit in areas that, you know, aren't that good. So you've got to pay attention where they're going to be coming from. And when you set your whole entire system up where you've got your bedding, your designed bedding, you've got your manipulated travel into your plot, and then you've got your access in a secure place where you can enter and exit. Those are just some of the main fundamental components that I never took into consideration when I was younger.
Right.
And when you put those fundamental, you know, pieces together, boy, it's lights out, you know, right. Game changer.
Right. So not only addressing deer movement outside of the food plot. So we're going to give them a place to bed. We're going to give them the mm-hmm. best option for travel, but we're manipulating movement even within the food plot, which is incredibly important.
Yep.
Especially for bow hunters. I feel like bow hunters, especially, you know, us with a long liberal gun season, we can have a little bit more freedom there. Like if you can hunt the rut during your gun season, you've got a little bit more freedom than the guys who are maybe working with archery tackle the entire season, right? So you've really got to be on your P's and Q's with how you're going to get those deer moving past the blind or the stand in the right location for your shot. So yeah, very, very good point there, Lee.
Yep.
Food plot architecture was not even a thing for us growing up. We planted a spot because the loggers left it open, right? This is where they parked their trailer and loaded the logs. Therefore, we sprinkled rye grain and some clover into it. You know, that was our food plot.
That's Southern food plotting 101, isn't it? Log landing, spray grain.
Yeah. And for a lot of guys, that's all they can do. You know what I mean? If you don't own the land, I mean, leasing is such a big thing down here. And if you don't own the land, that's all you've got. You've got that and your fire breaks. So you're going to end up with shaded out plots like Jake's talking about, if you're not careful, or you're going to end up with, small plots that are scattered on your road system, such that every time you try to drive in and out of the only road running through the middle of your property, you're bumping deer. You're blowing deer out, whether it be in the morning or in the evening. But yeah, food plot architecture. I'll never forget. I went on a hunt at a plantation in South Alabama for graduation. And I'm going to hunt this spot. And I've been hunting food plots my whole life, right? I think I'm 18 years old at this time. And the guy says, hey, instead of walking down the edge of the woods and climbing in the blind, walk down the middle of the food plot and then turn and go straight to the stand. And I thought, huh, why would I do that? And he said, that way, by the time they smell you, you could have shot them already. And I thought to myself, you know what? There's got to be a better way. Like, there's got to be a better way of doing this where we're not walking through a food plot. And then, you know, later I'm introduced to the concept of food plot architecture, which is obviously a game changer when it comes to hunting your plots, keeping them fresh throughout the year, stunning them, but keeping them fresh. I think that's the biggest thing. You're going to put all that time, all that energy, all that effort into creating a destination for the deer. Why not keep it as fresh as it can be throughout the year?
If you keep it fresh, that late season play, it's like a zoo. I mean, and you will own all your neighbor's deer. I don't have my deer density is extremely low. And late season, man, I'm like, wow, where did all these deer come from? The deer herds are nervous because there's, you know, deer that they've never seen before, and they're all right here in their home territory. It is a zoo if you stay off of that food plot through the year. Yeah. It's incredible.
Note to self, visit Lee in December. Sam, I think you're up next on the fails here.
Well, you guys kind of left me the softball of talking about timber cutting, so I guess I'll dive into some of that. I figured about every which way is the wrong way to cut a tree. And I think one of the most simple ones, and we talk about this all the time, like Jake referenced before, just cut the tree. You know, so much of this talk of how to open up an area for bedding, how to do a hinge cut. We have plenty of internet critics on the proper percentage of which to cut a tree and knock it over. But none of that matters if you don't get sunlight. And I think that's a thing that I learned the hard way early on, is starting to cut bedding areas. I thought, spent time making this meticulous area, these beautiful hinge cuts, you know, wrestled these trees down to the ground, cleaned up the trails, added beds, you know, did the whole nine yards within the bedding area. And at first, you know, we got some growth looking good, taking pictures of how that turned out and proud of myself. But then a season later, seeing some of these trees die, and a season later after that, seeing more die, and really not having the success I was looking for. And really the problem was light, not getting enough sunlight. And I want to tie back to the comment I said at the beginning of the podcast with nature being forgiving. I'd much rather screw up my cuts. In fact, the more I do this, in many ways, I'm an advocate of just doing flush cuts, either on the ground or up higher off the ground to generate new growth if they have stump sprouts, is, you know, doing those type of cuts to generate that new growth, because sometimes the energy it takes to keep that top alive, it wears all the tree and it's not going to come back. But back to the main point is getting that light down. And, you know, now I've gone to the point where I will completely open up the sky and let all kinds of light in. In fact, some of the cuts we've done on my property now, we did one a season ago that was very extensive. It was about a 5-acre, darn near clear cut of some really, really old red oak trees. And that just completely changed that landscape here. Now it's had two growing seasons behind it, last year and the year before. And having done that, now to see the jungle that's going to become from all those stump sprouts, I really enjoy walking through there and seeing the deer corridors, the hunting opportunities that we have on them. That's going to be a really phenomenal area in some place that was a deer desert because it had closed canopy, had good acorns. There's good acorn crop there, but really no habitat for deer. And now that we did that, that change that we put on the landscape has been substantial. And anytime I'm going to do a cutting, if I can, if there's any way we can get more trees down, that's what I'm doing. Because again, that rebound of nature, nature being forgiving, all that coming back up, that's the type of growth that we're looking for in habitat.
Yeah, that's a really, really good, a really good point. In talking with more and more people about cutting in bedding areas, I've found myself saying more often, you know, if this is a spot that we're managing specifically as bedding, like when in doubt, take it out. Like just you and Sam, I got this from you, and I've started to tell people this, and they sometimes they'll look at you kind of weird, but it's like for a bedding opportunity, you almost can't cut too much.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah,
I mean, if you clear cut the whole thing in 2 years, it's going to be a thick, nasty bedding area.
You cannot overcut it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's really good. Really, really good. Well, guys, I'm going to share. I don't know. I had a couple. Obviously, food plots. One equipment related. First food plot I ever planted. I rented a tiller and I busted every tooth off of that thing. But I bought the insurance, so I just returned it with a straight face and told them thank you, and walked back home. But I think the biggest one was probably the habitat project that I was most proud of. So I was on a parcel total. I only had like 20 acres right there where I was, but the larger piece back behind me was roughly, I don't know, 400 acres or so. There wasn't really any water, so to speak, on this property. So I put in a water hole that I was really happy about. And I had researched and figured out what I needed to do to put this water hole in. And I lined it with a nice liner and I, you know, put some clover around the edge so that it didn't cave in or, you know, didn't have any, you know, washing into it. Had the stick in there to make sure no rodents got in. And to top it all off, I ran a actual line up into it that I could run from my house. It was like 250 or 300 yards or so that I was able to pump water over to this water hole. I was really proud of this thing, and I did a lot of work to get it there. What I didn't realize was that the way I had set it up, when I turned the water off, I essentially had just created a siphon that siphoned every bit of water right back out of the pond or of the water hole because it was down at the bottom. And so as soon as I'd fill it up, it would push all the air out of the line. The water hole would be nice and full. It would look great. I'd turn off the water and it would proceed to suck every bit of that water right back down the line. So, and I bring that one up because that probably took me, I don't know, 3 solid days of work, you know, burying a line and doing the whole thing. And I'm bootstrapping it, right? I mean, this is with a shovel. Like there were no trenchers being used. There was no equipment being used for this. This was me and 20 acres just warring against each other. And yes, that was a pretty bad one. So folks, put your water holes in a place that don't depend on you to necessarily fill them up all the time. Like there are lots of spots where you can put them where you can play with the terrain a little bit. Let Mother Nature work for you rather than against you. Yes, there are times that we will have to artificially fill a water hole. Absolutely, I understand that. But as much as you can, if you've got a good spot and it's a good place where you want to have a water hole, by all means, don't stick a pipe in the bottom because it'll just suck it right back out. So it wasn't good. So anyway, I feel like there are probably a lot more fails we could talk about when it comes to water holes, but we'll leave it there for now. Folks, anything that we need to leave people with, any encouragement at this point? So maybe as we round the corner, we've messed up a lot of things, right? Like we've made a lot of mistakes. Any encouragement for folks as they are maybe stepping out onto their property, wanting to do some projects, but also feeling a little bit cautious and worried about making some mistakes.
I just say, don't be afraid and go do it. You know, it's okay to make mistakes. Every, like what Sam said, nature's forgiving. Everything for the most part is correctable. So yes, some things are not as correctable as others, but most everything you do, you can fix. Like I make mistakes every single year. There's something that I wish that I wouldn't have done. So you just kind of know what you did, make sure you make note of it and pay attention to that going forward and try to find a way to correct it the following season.
I'd tie into that and add into it and say, experiment, try new things and be intentional about it. Try some different plantings. Somebody will say, well, chestnut trees won't work. They didn't work for me. They didn't like my soil. Well, where did you plant it on your property? Maybe you should try another spot. Maybe you should get another dozen of them and put them in random spots, see how they do, check them a year later, learn. You know, every property, every soil type, every situation is so different and varied. Don't assume something from somebody else. You'll hear a lot of loud voices out there that'll say, well, this does work or that doesn't work, and they paint with a broad brush, but go try it. It might just work on your property and be successful for you.
Right. Right. I think I would recommend folks going into it, you know, one with eyes wide open and a willingness and a readiness to adapt. I think that if you are kind of on your toes just a bit, making sure that you're ready to make the changes that need to be made, making sure that you're not settling, you're not, okay, that's done, therefore I can just sit back, relax, and enjoy it. There is an element at which you can do that, but we need to always be making sure that the improvements that we're making are having the impact that we want them to. We need to be adapting if they aren't, and also maintaining. I think that's a huge thing as well. Something like a bedding area or a travel corridor, it's not permanent. Like there will need to be some maintenance and some upkeep depending on how well the deer use it and what's going on around it and what your neighbors end up doing with their property. So, well, guys, thanks so much for this conversation. I appreciate you throwing out there some of your biggest fails. So hopefully we'll take this, we'll cut it up into clips where we can make fun of you on Instagram. And yeah, it'll be great. So a little bit of a roast for all of us.
Sounds good.
All right, guys, thanks for joining me for this week's episode. Folks, if you have not already, please go check out our YouTube channel where you can find this podcast episode as well as all the habitat design breakdowns that we're doing. Thanks for listening to this week's show. If you found this helpful, do us a favor and leave us a review wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram at whitetail_partners, on Facebook, Whitetail Partners LLC, on YouTube by simply searching Whitetail Partners, or online at whitetailpartners.com.